Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it mean to appropriately regulate the internet? And what trade-offs do lawmakers need to consider as they respond to the concerns of content rights holders, public safety officials, and citizen users who want privacy and freedom in their online lives? Where once we had separate technologies to handle music, video, print, telephony, and computing, today's multipurpose devices and delivery platforms combine them all. And rather than passive receivers of information, many consumers today are also creators, contributors, and also distributors of content, blurring what used to be solid lines between the roles of policymakers, rights holders, and audiences. Joining us to talk about the consequences of this new reality is Cory Doctorow. He's a journalist, science fiction novelist, and co-editor of the blog Boing Boing. He's in town for UT Arlington's Distinguished Speaker Series. His talk is entitled What We Talk About When We Talk About Internet Regulation. That starts tonight at 7 and will be followed by a book signing. Cory, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have said that we can no longer expect to regulate copying or copyright without having broad implications for the internet as a whole. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, we tend to think of complicated things as having some inherent regulatability, right? If I said to you, you know, I've done a bunch of research and I've worked it out, and every car with a hands-free phone is at a much higher likelihood of getting into an accident. I want a rule that says you can't put a hands-free phone in a car. You may dispute whether that would be a good rule or bad rule, but you wouldn't say, well, once we do that, it's not a car anymore.
Right.
But general purpose things we think of as being non-regulatable. So if I said every bank robber has a car with four wheels on it, can't we remove the bank robbery feature from the wheel? You'd say, no, we don't know how to do it. And I said, well, we could try, right? We could do something. Couldn't we put a GPS on every wheel and maybe a microphone so we could listen to what you were doing and so on? And you'd go, well, on the one hand, I don't think that would stop bank robbers because they just break all that stuff off. And on the other hand, holy moly, that would have a lot of incursions into other areas of our life. We think of computers as being complicated and therefore regulatable. So it sounds kind of reasonable on its face to say, can't you just design me a computer that can do everything except for copy, you know, Hollywood movies without permission? Or can't we just have an internet that allows like any two parties to communicate any message using any protocol except if it upsets me? And the closest approximation we have to that, to removing the copying feature or the bad speech feature from computers and the internet is we add spyware to them,
mm-hmm.
right? So we add technology that runs in the background on the computer, watches what you do, and tries to stop you doing things that you're prohibited from doing or that some business owner would like you to stop doing. Once you add that facility to a computer, it's impossible for that facility to only be used by good people to do reasonable things. Once you design computers so they sneak around behind their owners' backs, people will use them to sneak around behind their owners' backs. So a really good example is Sony BMG. Big record label, shipped 6 million CDs with some secret anti-copying software. Secret because nobody wants anti-copying software in their computer. You know, no one woke up and said, gosh, you know what I need is a CD that lets me do less. So the software, when you put the CD in your computer for the first time, it covertly installed itself and it changed your operating system so that there were processes that your operating system couldn't see. It would be running, but your operating system wouldn't know they were there. So if you said, list all the programs running, it wouldn't show up. And there were files your computer couldn't see. So if you said, you know, what files are in this directory, it wouldn't show you that. And they did that because they wanted to run a process in the background that checked to see if you were copying music. And if you were, it would shut that down. But as soon as that was known, as soon as we knew it existed, virus writers started writing viruses that cloaked themselves using it because you just punch this huge hole in the immune system of a computer. It had this blind spot. You could run processes that it couldn't see. And so, you know, later on, there were 6 million CDs shipped with this malicious software on it. And later on, we found evidence that it was running on 250,000 American political and government and military networks, right? So this was a total disaster. And it's a kind of microcosm for what keeps happening when we try to do this. And so we don't know how to make computers worse at copying. We just add spyware when we try. And computers aren't probably going to get any worse at copying. That seems pretty inconceivable. I really feel like you know, in a generation or two, my grandchildren will be sitting around the table with me at Christmas one year, and they'll say, tell me again, Grandpa, how stupidly hard it was to copy things in 2012. Right? Tell me again when we didn't have hard drives the size of your fingernail that cost less than a pack of gum, hanging in blister packs of 10 at the checkout line at Walgreens, that could hold all the songs ever made, all the movies ever made, all the words ever spoken, and so on. So if copying's not going to get harder, and if every time we try to regulate copying, we add spyware to all of our devices, this is a problem, right? We need strategies for coping with it. And, you know, I earn my living from copyright. I'd like to find those strategies, but I'd like them to, A, be effective. It's not enough to just say, well, something must be done. I've done something. There, something is done. You know, I'd like it to actually work. And I'd also like to inhabit a world where we don't add technology to computers that makes it hard to be free, private, and free from interference by crooks and snoops and corrupt governments and whoever else gets access to computers. Because, of course, it's not just the American government that may want to add spyware to computers. It's the Syrian government and the Chinese government that also wants to have spyware running on computers and might exploit a facility put in there at the behest of rights holders.
So there are some things that I think most reasonable people agree that we should try to prevent online, mm-hmm. things like child pornography. And mm-hmm. this is something that you've dealt with, and you agree that this should be illegal.
Oh, yeah.
And
I've got a 4-year-old daughter.
Yeah. So how do we set up a system where we focus on the things that really matter and that maybe with a concerted effort we might have control over without getting in the way of activities that you and I might find objectionable but other people agree are okay and that are sort of that gray area?
So I guess this is one of those examples where, especially with child porn, you want to do stuff that works and not just stuff that you can trumpet as having been
a thing that we tried.
Right, yeah. It's right. what Bruce Schneier calls security theater at the airport, right? You know, it's like, it's, you know, I know that you're all afraid. I've done something to make you less afraid. It won't make the airplane safer, but you're all less afraid because you can see me putting on this puppet show about security. Child porn, I want us to do stuff about child porn, not just like pretend to do stuff about child porn. So how do we track down child pornography users today? What's our best remedy? Well, we find them using the internet. And we use police to infiltrate them. And then we get warrants and we serve them on their internet service providers. And then we track them down. And then we use prosecutorial tactics to figure out where their suppliers were. And then we go and we track those people down and we arrest them. Like 2 weeks ago in Ontario, where I'm from, that happened. Mm-hmm. Right? They arrested this big, not just people trading images, people making images. The most horrific thing you can imagine. And we did it through police work. What doesn't work? Well, what doesn't work is we will build a national firewall and we will add to it the URLs of sites that have child porn so that people won't be able to see child porn. Because those firewalls don't work, right? I mean, China has got like more engineers than any other country in the world. They have not really any due process, right? So the deterrent effect of their laws is as great as it could be because, you know, the ultimate penalty for anything is, you know, we take you and we harvest your organs and give them to party members, right? So, you know, clearly, like, they have no interference with any deterrent effect, right? They don't have to convince Congress that this is proportionate. And they spend more money and time than any other country in the world on building censoring firewalls. And they totally fail to censor their country. So if they can't do it, we can. Mm-hmm. And when we try, we end up in these really weird places. Because one of the things about child porn firewalls, because there are a bunch of them, there's one in the UK where I live, one in Canada, Scandinavia has one, Australia has one, and so on, is that the contents of those firewalls end up being secret. Because the argument is, well, the firewall must work, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't have it. So if we told you what was in the firewall, so we should be able to tell you what's in the firewall. You should be able to know that this is blocking www.childporn.com and www.childporn.org and so on, because the firewall should work and keep you out. But of course, the people who make the firewall know that it doesn't work. So they won't tell you what URLs are in it, because that would just be like a phone book for looking up child porn. So now you have a secret list of websites that you're not allowed to look at. And, you know, the civil libertarians, the instinctive reaction to that would be, oh, my gosh, if you had that, it would be abused and governments would use it and to hide things that they didn't like. And everyone else says, oh, no, you're just being paranoid. But we have some evidence about this. So WikiLeaks liberated and published the child porn list from Sweden and Denmark. 98.5% of the material that they had secretly blocked on a secret basis as child porn wasn't child porn. It was just other stuff. because, you know, Anton Chekhov said it, when you've got a gun on the mantelpiece in Act One, it'll go off by Act Three. You know, when you create the Patriot Act and say, if someone you think someone's a terrorist as opposed to just some other kind of bad guy, you don't need a warrant. Well, all of a sudden, policemen whose job it is to get the job done as easily and quickly as possible find ways to stretch reality so that everyone they're chasing isn't just a drug dealer, but a drug dealer who might have a link to a terrorist. And all of a sudden, no one has a warrant. Once there's a loophole, the loophole expands to take over everything. So once we create loopholes for prior restraint on speech, then that loophole becomes expanded to encompass everything that's just kind of impolitic, icky, not nice, but not child porn. And it diverts resource from doing what actually works to catch child pornographers, which is having the police find child porn websites, infiltrate them, and then go down and arrest those people.
Well, I mean, you could argue about the extent to which this matters, but who decides what's child porn and what's not? There are also questions about that, because this can be done with a sort of computer filter. This can be done by human beings that you hire to go and scrub these things. Years ago, I took pictures of my kids when they were very small in the bathtub, and there was nothing sexual about them at all. They were not printed for me when I sent off to Shutterfly, and I finally realized after trying this twice, oh, they must have some kind of filter that says absolutely not.
Probably a person, I would think. And you're right.
They really were very innocent, I should say.
Absolutely. I mean, I have pictures of my own daughter in the bath, and she loves looking at them, right? I show her, we have a picture of her first bath, and when she won't let us wash her hair, we pull it out as evidence that once upon a time she let us wash her hair. And say, you know, can't you be more like you were when you were 4 weeks old? But in a good way. It's true that it's hard to adjudicate some edge cases around child porn. I think that there's some middle cases that we can all agree on, right? I mean, there are edge cases. You know, Lewis Carroll took naked pictures of two-year-olds. The guy wrote Alice in Wonderland. By all accounts, all of his biographers, everybody who's looked at them, they all agree, perfectly chaste. And then there's some weird edge cases, like there's a Scorpions album cover that has a picture of a naked seven-year-old girl on the cover. And in fact, cover appears in the Wikipedia entry for the Scorpions. And on that basis, all of Wikipedia was blocked by the British child porn filter.
The entire site, not this page.
The entire site. And there was a great big argument about it. And one of the people who weighed in on the argument was the little girl, who's now an adult woman, who said, it's not child porn. So it's hard to adjudicate those edge cases. There are some middle cases that are absolutely horrific and that we all agree about and that I would love to see shut down. Right. I don't think that there's – I think that we can talk a lot about these weird edge cases around, and they'd make a great law seminar or a great media theory seminar. But there's a bunch of stuff in the middle that's just like horrific criminal activity, and the people who perpetrate it should be behind bars and then in some sort of therapeutic rehabilitation. I think we can all agree about that. But if we agree that that's real and if we agree that it's important, then we should do actual stuff to fix it and not just stuff that is politically expedient or looks nice.
So what about, you know, if you block an entire site like Wikipedia, clearly people are losing out a lot more than they are protected from. Can you speak to that a bit?
Yeah. Although before I get there, can I say one more thing?
Sure.
Because this is an important gloss that's often missed. So say there's a rule that says there's a book you can't import into the U.S., right? A Al-Qaeda manual or something. And what we do is websites that block it, that offer it for sale, they know they're not allowed to sell it. We can do that without knowing everything that you read. But if we want to make sure that every link that you visit isn't child porn, we have to look at every link you visit. So there is no, in the internet, censorship is surveillance. And that's also a big difference.
Cory Doctorow is with us. He's a journalist, science fiction novelist, and co-editor of the blog Boing Boing. He's in town for UT Arlington's Distinguished Speaker Series. His appearance takes place tonight at 7, and it's called What We Talk About When We Talk About Internet Regulation. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Cory Doctorow. He's co-editor of the blog Boing Boing, also a science fiction novelist. He'll speak tonight at UT Arlington's Distinguished Speaker Series. His talk is entitled What We Talk About When We Talk About Internet Regulation. It starts at 7 and will be followed by a book signing. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think at kera.org. So, Cory, some people say, all right, maybe governments don't have the time or the resources to do this. So let's ask ISPs. Let's give them a series of guidelines and ask ISPs to be responsible for all the content they handle. Why is that untenable?
Well, I think it's a question of scale. And it's also, as you said at the beginning, we no longer have a distinction between the media that we use to communicate and the media that we use to receive content. The broadcast and the two-way medium are really the same. So look at YouTube. YouTube's getting something like 80 hours of video per minute. Now, Viacom is suing YouTube because they say that they should do more to filter copyright. They say that someone who knows what they're doing, who understands copyright law, should look at all of the things that are uploaded to YouTube before they go live and make sure that they don't infringe copyright, that they pass the giggle test. So even assuming that you could expand the pool of people who are allowed to do that from just lawyers to like paralegals too, if you took like all of the copyright lawyer hours and paralegal hours that remain between now and the heat death of the universe, you wouldn't make a dent in YouTube.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Well, it means that there would be a lot less YouTube. Now, YouTube's got a lot of different things in it. It's got a lot of infringing clips from Viacom, as Viacom has shown in its court case. It's got a lot of silly videos of, you know, someone playing with a cute animal. And it's got videos of Syrian dissidents being slaughtered in the street by their government. And it's got videos of just last month, there was this terrible video of a 16-year-old girl in Texas who had secretly recorded her father, who was a judge, beating her up. And he lost his job as a judge because the people, having seen that video, which he really couldn't have gotten out in any other way, decided that it wasn't appropriate for their judiciary. So it's all of that, right? It's the single wire that delivers freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and a free press. And you can't just regulate one corner of that without impinging on the other two.
So it's like regulating paper 100 years ago.
Yeah. We've had two different ways of approaching this with what lawyers call intermediaries, people who sit between someone who speaks and someone who hears. One is a common carrier, like a phone company. The phone company doesn't have to do anything except respond to warrants to make sure that you're not infringing copyright or planning a kidnapping or being obscene or any of those things. It's not their job. They're the phone company. And then the other end of that is what's called strict liability, and that's like a cable operator. So if you're the cable operator, your job is you are required to make sure that nothing you air, not even like a live segment on one of the channels that just happens to be in your feed, infringes copyright. And the way that you do that is you get the person who makes the show to indemnify the channel, and the person who makes the channel, or the person who owns the channel, indemnifies the cable network. And so if I come and sue the cable network for infringing my copyright because a live segment on a news show infringed my copyright, they can just pass the liability on to the channel, who can pass it on to the show. But 16-year-old girls from Texas aren't going to be able to indemnify YouTube. And even if they could, we couldn't even review the contract without doing some major throttling. So it becomes this incredibly burdensome regulation on speech, on kinds of stuff that we think of as being outside the realm of government interference, either in the name of defending copyright or preventing crime.
So as someone who makes at least part of your living from material that you have created yourself, sweated over, edited, obviously you deserve to make a living from what you do. So what are the solutions for people who are creating content? There are people out there who are agreeing that we need to not overregulate. Mm. And that there are other people who are saying, well, I can't produce if I don't have the rights to control this content exclusively.
So deserves an interesting word there. Most of the people who've pursued a career in the arts didn't earn a living, even if they were good and even if they tried hard. And most of the people who will ever pursue a living in the arts won't make a living, even if they try hard and even if they're good. And that's just kind of a fact of the way the economics of art work. It's because people make art well beyond any kind of rational economic reason for doing so. Mm-hmm. You know, even if there's not a market for poetry, people still write poetry because they're moved to write poetry. So it's that intersection of culture and economics has always been difficult. I mean, if you're thinking of going into writing novels to pay your bills and pay your mortgage and support your family, you shouldn't, right? I mean, speaking as someone who writes novels to support my family and pay my bills, I did something else until I got there and was prepared to never get there because I'm realistic.
Mm-hmm.
The internet has changed who earns a living from their art, but it hasn't eliminated earning a living from art. Website TechDirt had a great report, very thoroughly documented, citing sources like the OECD and the General Accounting Office, showing that the overall size of the entertainment industry is actually expanding in every sector. There's more money being made from video, more money being made from music, more money being made from books, but they're being made by different people in different ways. And in general, the benefits being spread more thinly. So a larger number of people are sharing a larger pool, but it's not clumping up the way that it used to. So you've got a few millionaires and a bunch of people with no income. Now you've got a smaller number of millionaires and a bunch of people with fairly insignificant amounts of income, but it's double their no income. That's okay. I mean, I can live with that. You know, back in the era of radio, the first era of radio and recorded music, all the people who'd earned their living from music till then had been vaudeville performers, live performers. And the radio people, they said, we've got a great business model for you. You can opt into BMI, and BMI will blanket license your music to us, and we'll put it on the radio, and we'll send you a check. And they said things like, how dare you? I'm a performer. I do something as old and as holy as that first story told in front of the first fire. I'm not a mere clerk. I'm not going to sit in a back room while you present my work to the world. And then 70 years later, the performers who, in fact, the studio performers, the recording artists who, in fact, ended up displacing those vaudeville performers, they're going around and saying, how dare you tell me that I have to tour to earn a living with my music? I'm not a trained monkey. I'm a white-collar worker. I labor indoors. And when I'm done, some, you know, man of commerce takes my work to the rest of the world. Technology giveth and technology taketh away. So long as there's still music and so long as there are still people who have a chance at least of winning that lottery, it doesn't really matter who are the winners and who are the losers.
So if you are going to make something and make it available for sale or delivery online, mm-hmm. and you have been the creator of that content, it does stand to reason, though, that you would be the one who would be allowed to sell it, as opposed to somebody who came along, made that very easy copy and said, hey, guess what? I've got Cory Doctorow's latest novel right here, and I'll give it to you for $5, and he's charging 20.
Well, so that's almost never the problem with online piracy. In mm-hmm. fact, if there's one segment that file sharing has really destroyed its commercial piracy, right? You just don't get the people selling crappy $1 DVDs in quantity the way you did 15 years ago. In China, the pirate markets are all but blown up and dried away. When I was in Hong Kong 15 years ago and I went to the night market, it was filled with
VCD stalls on
vendors.
The street. Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. They're all gone, right? Because as between paying a dollar to a dodgy seller on the road and downloading it over BitTorrent, why would you pay the dodgy seller on the road, right? There's just like no market there for it. And it's really, you know, the last bastion of DVD piracy or music piracy where someone actually sells a product either online or in the physical world. It's just like that tiny dwindling minority of people who don't have fast internet access and don't know how to use it. And that's a problem that self-corrects. And really the thing that everyone is worried about in the so-called content world, the world of music and books and movies, isn't stuff being sold without them being cut in for a piece. It's it being given away.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Bob in Hearst. Hey, Bob.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you guys doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question, and you were talking about it right before you took the call, was about online music piracy. My example is, let's say the Rolling Stones broadcast something on broadcast television and somebody made a recording of it, and now they're offering that recording file as a file share free download off the internet. Is seeing how it was broadcast once already, is that a copyright violation? Is that an illegal download or not?
Well, it's definitely an illegal download. I mean, I'm not a copyright lawyer, but I've spent enough time hanging around with them. I used to negotiate copyright treaties in Geneva at WIPO, at the UN agency that does this stuff. And I can tell you pretty unequivocally that's a copyright violation. A better question might be, should it? And historically, what's happened when you have that kind of problem where you have works being created that it's really hard to control, instead of saying, okay, everyone who copies them is a crook, and instead of saying, well, there's no rules at all, it's a free-for-all, we've generally done something like blanket licensing. So this radio station, for example, pays a fee every month. And if you wanted to drop the needle on a record, you wouldn't need to call up Mick Jagger's agent and go, like, I'm about to play Start Me Up. Is that 10 cents or 15 cents? Right? You just pay a blanket license that gives you all the music ever recorded. Lots of ISPs have said, we would love to buy that blanket license, right? Hairdressing salons can buy that license. Cafes can buy that license. Karaoke bars buy that license. High school gymnasiums buy that license. We want that license. We want to say to our customers, we've paid a fee, and that gives you the right to download all the music that you want. And none of the labels so far have been willing to offer that license.
Let's talk about this. You were invited to participate in the last EG8 summit, and you chose not to go.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I didn't think that – I thought that it would be all of it framed as, have you stopped beating your wife yet?
Hmm.
So I thought that the whole of it would – that they would show up and they would stage manage – and this is in fact what happened. They would stage manage the process so that what you had were a bunch of rights holder groups whose representatives got to go up on stage and say piracy is destroying music and it must be solved. And unless you have an answer to that problem, we don't want to hear from you. And then when someone stood up and said, well, actually, there's lots of music that isn't being destroyed by piracy, they would say, didn't you hear? Piracy is being destroyed by music. Right. And so I thought that it was a fix. And it was. I mean, that is essentially how it unspooled. I mean, Sarkozy, who convened the meeting, the president of France, doesn't have a great track record on this. I mean, he passed a law called Hadopi. And Hadopi says that if you're accused of three acts of copyright infringement without really any evidence or a court proceeding, they take away your family's internet access. And, you know, your family's internet access isn't just how you download music. It's how everybody in your household does their job, gets their education, communicates with their relatives elsewhere, and so on. It's a kind of death penalty for the information society. And the fact that we would give it not just to one person, but collectively to everyone who lives within range of their Wi-Fi access point, and without even a proper court hearing, seems to me to be so disproportionate. You know, the European Court of Human Rights actually told him that he couldn't pass the law, and he added a kind of fig leaf. There's a traffic court now that you can go through where you get like 1 minute to plead your case, and the European Court of Justice decided that was enough. But it really seems like it's not. So I didn't trust that he was operating in good faith. I don't like him politically, and I think my suspicions were borne out.
So in this country last month, it looked very clear that the Stop Online Piracy Act was going to pass. And then at the last minute, there was this delay. I would imagine that you think that the delay, if nothing else, was a good thing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that it was a good thing because lawmakers have been hearing a lot from their constituents. I mean, in very big numbers, even before the very big push from their constituents saying, this is crazy, you can't do this. And in particular, they've been hearing from technical experts who were saying the external effects of this proposed regulation are really, really drastic and have nothing to do with music or piracy, that they're really about the security of everyday internet users. So, for example, this DNS blocking, which is a very technical concept, but basically they were going to fiddle with the way that computers change the name of a website into the numeric address that it uses to find it. So just like, you know, Bob's Country Barbecue has a latitude and longitude, www.google.com has an IP address.
Right.
And they were going to change that. And the problem with that is that all the systems that we're building now to stop what's called phishing, which is when you think you're at your bank's website entering your password, but you're not. You're at a website that looks just like it, and that somehow they've tricked your computer into showing the name of the bank's website in the top of your location bar. They would all have been broken and undermined by SOPA, by website blocking. And one of the things that SOPA had to protect website blocking was another provision that made it illegal to make tools that interfered with website blocking. So all the efforts that we're making today to stop the billions of dollars in internet fraud, where people are losing their life savings, or people's hard drives are being plundered for the kids, the photos of their kids in the bath, or all those other horrific incursions, they would have been undermined by this. And when the technical experts said this to Lamar Smith, who's a local lawman here, he said, I don't believe it. I don't, you know, I've heard from the experts from the Motion Picture Association. That's good enough for me. We're not holding hearings on that. Sorry.
So do you think that lawmakers fully understand the issue? I mean, you know, everything that happens, I would imagine, in the United States government and all over the world these days, a lot of it is influenced by lobbies and people who have money to make and money to protect. Do they not get what they're talking about, what they're making laws about?
Well, I don't think they necessarily need to, right? I mean, housing affects every corner of our life, but we don't say that every lawmaker needs to understand architecture and home engineering in order to become a lawmaker. What I think they need to be able to do is not have expertise in every technical area that they pass laws about, but rather have an equitable and transparent process about entertaining opinions from lots of different corners, scholars and engineers and companies and all the rest of it. And the problem is the thing you said at the start, which is money, which is that if you look at the lawmakers who supported SOPA, they were given 10 times more entertainment lobby money than the lawmakers who didn't. And it seems like it's pretty much quid pro quo. In fact, former Senator Chris Dodd, who now heads the Motion Picture Association of America, is in real trouble because he gave an interview with Fox News afterwards in which he said Obama is going to find that having not done everything in his power to give us our law, that he's not going to get the campaign contributions that he's counting on from our industry, which sounds an awful lot like quid pro quo. It's a little bit further than you're supposed to go, especially if you're a former very senior senator. You're not supposed to say we paid for that law and we expect to get it.
Are there democratic countries in the world that you think are handling this appropriately?
Every country has its bright spots and its dark spots. You know, Senator Wyden here is a great senator on this stuff. In Canada, there are lawmakers like, say, Charlie Angus, a member of parliament, who's also a musician, who's very good on this stuff. But by and large, the parliamentary processes themselves, the congressional processes themselves, everywhere seem to be really in trouble, and not just about copyright, about everything. There's a group called RootStrikers.org that Lawrence Lessig has founded to try and do campaign reform, and I think that's the right approach.
My guest is Cory Doctorow. He's a journalist, co-editor of the blog Boing Boing, and science fiction novelist. He's in town for UT Arlington's Distinguished Speaker Series. He'll be on stage tonight at 7, and his lecture is entitled What We Talk About When We Talk About Internet Regulation. We'll continue the conversation with Cory in a couple of minutes. You can join us online at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Cory Doctorow. He's co-editor of the blog Boing Boing, and he's in town for UT Arlington's Distinguished Speaker Series. He'll be on stage tonight at 7 talking about what we talk about when we talk about internet regulation. Join our conversation over the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Gabriella in Dallas. Hello, Gabriella.
Hello, and I have a question because your guest earlier mentioned BMI, which is Broadcast Music, Inc., I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the regulation of these entities. I am a small business owner, and suddenly I've been getting bills from a new entity that I didn't know of its existence. And I imagine that in economic times, people are out there searching for possible revenue leads that they didn't have in the past, but a company has suddenly appeared to me after many years in business saying that they're also a licensing company. What is the arrangement, does he know, between the established companies like ASCAP and BMI for music, specifically for small independent businesses such as myself, in paying those fees? How does one not leave themselves open for anybody else to come along, or what's the control factor within the government that says such amount of entities exist and that's it? Or is this just an open ground for anybody to set up their own little licensing and royalties scenario?
Yeah, I'm sorry that I can't give you a technical answer to that. I mean, I can say that historically when your job is to solve a problem, part of your job becomes to make sure that the problem never goes away. And that has been a problem with collecting societies, that they always want to expand the pool of people they want to collect from. But in the case of the internet, what you have is ISPs begging to buy licenses. Not the problem you're describing, which is a real problem. I don't want to minimize it. But a totally opposite problem, where people are just like begging for the right to pay them money so that they can get legit instead of having to police their users. And so far, nobody wants to offer them that license.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here that asks, how do we convince the non-technical public that open software and hardware are important and ultimately products that are superior to proprietary systems? I don't know whether you agree with that or not.
I do. And I guess the way that I think about this is, you know, back in the old days, pre-Enlightenment, we didn't have science. We had alchemy. And alchemy is a lot like science, except you don't tell anyone what you've learned or how anything that you've done works. And so that means that every alchemist discovered for himself that drinking mercury was a bad idea. And alchemy didn't go very far. And then we started publishing. We started telling people how stuff worked, what we'd learned, and how it all went. And engineering in particular, engineering and science, are built on that model. There's no such thing really as proprietary engineering. You know, you've got a very nice broadcast center here. The firm of engineers who helped your architects design it didn't keep any of the stress forces that they calculated a secret. The as-built drawings aren't a secret from you. You're allowed to know what's in the walls. You would never buy a radio center that was designed by people who wouldn't tell you what calculations they made to make it or what's in the walls. Our software today is designed on the alchemical model. Right. Microsoft won't tell you what the source is, and they won't tell you how it works, and they tell you that it's proprietary, and they tell you that knowing what's going on inside it is illegal. And in many cases, you know, if you're an iOS vendor, if you make software for the iPhone, you have to sign non-disclosure agreements. So if you discover things in the inner workings of the technology, you're not allowed to tell anyone this. So just last week, a company called Path surprised the world by harvesting all the contents of their iPhone contacts database, their address book, and uploading it to Path servers. And people went, wait, did you violate the security of my iPhone? And it turns out, no, that's just built into the iPhone. And Angry Birds does it too. Right? So I think that alchemy kind of solves itself because everyone ends up drinking mercury. But at the same time, it's a maddening process to be around when alchemists are prescribing mercury for your friends. And you kind of wish that they would take some evidence-based medicine.
I think it's vexing for a lot of consumers who don't necessarily it's not even that they're not capable of understanding all the back end stuff. They just don't want to. They don't have time. They want their Angry Birds to work. And often there are these long disclosures that may or may not explain that this might happen to you, but people don't read them. I mean, what do we need? Would it make sense to have legislation that at least required disclosures to be brief and comprehensible?
Maybe. I mean, I actually I think that the better solution to this is to repeal rules against reverse engineering. So right now, since 1998, we've had this thing called anti-circumvention in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And what that says is that if there's a digital lock on a device that stops you from getting access to a copyrighted work, it's illegal to remove the digital lock, even if you're not violating copyright. So the lock itself has some inherent protection. So it's illegal to tell people how to remove the lock. It's illegal to tell people how the lock works. It's illegal to remove the lock. And what that means is that device vendors are able to build flaws into devices, have flaws in their devices, and opening up the device to see how it works, which you may not do, but which a competitor of the vendor may do, right? Mm-hmm. It may be that there's someone who makes Android devices who would like to reverse engineer iPhones so that they can write an app that you can install on your iPhone that would harvest all of your contacts and all of your SMSs and everything and move them over to your Android phone if you wanted to switch. And that's illegal, right? And the process of making that legal again, making it legal to break a lock if you're not violating copyright law in some other way, would then create a whole bunch of companies whose job it would be to figure out how devices worked and then publish their workings, and those flaws would become something that you'd see in the popular press.
And, of course, it removes the disincentive to people, for example, switching between an iPhone and an Android that exists mm-hmm. right now. And I guess the reason they exist is because these powerful companies have influence?
Yeah. I mean, right now, you know, I don't think Apple wants to keep the workings of the iPhone secret because they don't want you to know that the contact database could be harvested. They said that was a mistake, and I believe them. I think the reason that they do it is they just want to lock you in, right? They want you to spend Every dollar that you spend in the app store, they take 30 cents out of, and they want to make sure that no one else builds an app store that competes with theirs. The impact of that, though, is really weird for creators. So if you write an iPhone app, and I have an iPhone, and I want to buy it from you, because I need to break the digital lock off my iPhone in order to install your app without Apple's permission, it's illegal for you to sell it to me, and it's illegal for me to buy it. And it seems hard to square that with any theory of what copyright should do, right? You know, if you believe copyright should create markets, well, that's not creating a market. If you believe it should serve creators, it's not serving creators. There's no equitable reason for it. And every 3 years, the Copyright Office considers exemptions to this. And there was one, a minor one, for iPhones, not iPads or other things, but for iPhones in the last round. And Apple strenuously objected to it. And they continue to object to it in the current one. There's another one underway right now that's trying to expand it to iPads and iPod Touches and so on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Matthew in Denton. Hi, Matthew.
Hello. Good morning. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Okay. So here's my question. I know that the entertainment industry has a history of attacking, like, technology. I mean, if you look at the past, like the RIAA or the MPAA, you know, have been, like, attacking things like video cassette recorders and then MP3s, and now it's the internet. I mean, is this behavior from the entertainment industry, is this always going to keep on happening? I mean, is there a point where, I guess, these industries are going to embrace or change their ways and start embracing these new technologies instead of fighting against them?
So I think what you're describing is actually that the people who make the pirate technology of yesteryear become the industrial barons of this year and object to the next one. I call it every pirate wants to be an admiral. So, you know, the first round of this was the record, the phonogram. And John Philip Sousa, the great American composer, said that if phonograms were allowed to exist, the infernal talking machines would cause our vocal cords to seize up and atrophy the way that our tails fell off when we came down out of the trees, right? And then and yet the performers who were fighting the composers over the record managed to make an industry out of records. And then the radio came along and started playing records on the radio. And the people who had taken the compositions and made recordings out of them said, well, when we did that, that was progress. But what you radio people are doing, that's totally piracy. And the radio people said, no, we need, this is progress. And of course, a few years later, broadcasters started to sue the cable operators because the cable operators were taking those broadcast signals and putting them down over community access TV. And they said, you know, when we took records and put them on the radio, that was progress. But when you took our broadcast signals and put them on a cable, that's just piracy. And then the cable operators sued the VCR, right? Sued Sony over the VCR, 1976 to 1984, this Supreme Court case. Jack Valenti, the head of the Motion Picture Association in 1982, said, I say to you, the VCR is to the American film industry as the Boston Strangler is to a woman home alone. And you know, the VCR was legalized, and Sony, the company that made the VCR and fought for the VCR in the Supreme Court, then turned around and became one of the studios that's now suing file-sharing sites. So every pirate wants to be an admiral. And I fully expect that if Mega Upload, for example, this file-sharing site that was just shut down, if they're exonerated, I think in 40 years they'll be part of the rights holder lobby.
There's also this reality that there are certain devices that are purpose-built to sort of self-destruct if they are used in a way that the manufacturer believes is not appropriate. And I think as consumers, that really frustrates us because if I've purchased something, it doesn't matter if I use it as a, you know, as a phone or as a music player, as a roller skate after I've paid for it.
Yeah, I mean, the Nintendo 3DS is a good example of that. If you have a Nintendo 3DS, when you turn it on, it tries to connect to the internet, and even if you tell it not to, and then find new operating systems for itself, even if you tell it not to. And if it finds an updated operating system, it downloads it and installs it, even if you tell it not to. And then when that new operating system is installing, it checks to see whether the old one was tampered with. Mm-hmm. And if it finds that it's been tampered with, it shuts itself down, and it never turns on again. Right. And so they claim that this is an anti-piracy measure. It may be. It also has the nice effect for them of stopping you buying software for your Nintendo from anyone else. So they can continue to charge royalty for everyone who's allowed to make software for this device. This has some security implications, obviously, because one way that you could attack someone is by making it appear to the internal security systems that their device has been tampered with and it would shut itself down. And the other problem, of course, here is that users themselves might want to legitimately tamper with their devices, might have a reason to do it. The way to solve that, I think, is just to get rid of anti-circumvention. If it's not against the law to figure out what's going on in the device when it turns itself into a brick, then you can go into business selling tools to de-brick your Nintendo 3DS. And that would be a pretty good business. And then people would start asking themselves, why on earth is Nintendo turning their devices into bricks?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Umar in Arlington. Hi, Umar.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I was wondering, I'm a student at UT Arlington. Mm-hmm. And so a big thing over here is jailbreaking our iPhones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was wondering, does that make it, is it illegal to do so? Because it is creating like it's taking out that lock.
Yeah, so that's one of the exemptions that was passed 2 years and 10 months or so ago. So right now it's legal to jailbreak your iPhone. It may be illegal again in 2 months. And what remains illegal is telling anyone how to jailbreak their iPhone or making a tool to jailbreak your iPhone. So it's a pretty fraught area. And it's not legal to jailbreak your iPad or iPod, just your iPhone. So these very, very narrow exemptions are passed by the Copyright Office every 3 years, and then they expire.
You say it's illegal. I know that you can go online in a million places and find this information. So is it simply not being enforced?
That's right. It's not enforced. The problem with it being illegal is not that it's impossible to do or even very hard to do. It's impossible to judge quality, right? Consumer mm-hmm. Report is never going to do an issue on which iPod jailbreaking software is really iPod jailbreaking software and which iPod jailbreaking software is, in fact, a kind of honeypot that, while it jailbreaks your iPhone, also allows someone to remotely operate your camera and your microphone and read all your texts and listen in on your calls and watch you enter your passwords into websites. And that's the kind of thing that consumers want to know before they jailbreak their iPhones. And so it would be really nice if it was legal to make the tools, because then we could have an orderly marketplace for tools. It's a bit like bathtub gin, you know. It wasn't hard to get bathtub gin, but every now and again when you bought bathtub gin, you went blind.
Mm-hmm. So are you optimistic about the future, or do you really foresee a long, dark future?
As they say in computer engineering, I think you've got an OR gate where an AND gate belongs. I am both optimistic and pessimistic. Mm-hmm. I think to be an activist means to be optimistic and believe that if we get together, something can be done, but a pessimist in believing that if we don't do anything, things will get very bad.
Do you think it's a tech savvy versus tech naive problem?
I think there's something to that. And I think that, you know, the way that computers and networks expands all of our lives. You know, my grandparents are avid Skypers because it's a way for them to see their great-granddaughter in the United Kingdom where I live, and they live in Toronto, right? So every one of us every year finds another reason that computers are relevant to us and will continue to. And so the consequences become more apparent to us.
Cory Doctorow will be speaking tonight at UT Arlington's Distinguished Speaker Series. His lecture is entitled What We Talk About When We Talk About Internet Regulation. That starts at 7 and will be followed by a book signing. Cory, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Cheers.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.